It's Wednesday, July 7th, 2021, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the studio in the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, the Justice Department announces arrests in the January 6th Capitol riots, people who attacked journalists. We'll discuss the coverage of Bill Cosby's release from prison, how his accusers responded, and how Howard University found itself in the middle. And
come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination.
The 50th anniversary of one of the most whimsical films of the 20th century, Gene Wilder's Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our time is up today, but we're going to go back to Howard University. I mentioned a few seconds ago that we'd be talking about how Howard ended up in the center of the reaction to Bill Cosby's release from prison, but that's not the only reason the university is making headlines this week. Yesterday morning, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones went on CBS This Morning and told Gayle King that even though the University of North Carolina did vote to give her tenure, she would be joining the faculty at Howard University instead. She will be the inaugural night chair in race and journalism there. King asked her flat out, why at an HBCU? Couldn't she have more impact at another school, one that clearly doesn't get it the way that Howard does?
I have been very, very thoughtful about my decision to go to an historically black college. And what I decided is, since the second grade, when I started being bused into white schools, I've spent my entire life proving that I belonged in elite white spaces that were not built for black people. And I just decided, you know, I got a lot of clarity through what happened with the University of North Carolina. I decided I didn't want to do that anymore, that black professionals should feel free and actually perhaps an obligation to go to our own institutions and bring our talents and resources to our own institutions and help to build them up as well. This is not my fight. I fought the battle that I wanted to fight, which is I deserve to be treated equally and have a vote on my tenure. I won that battle. But it's not my job to heal the University of North Carolina. That's the job of the people in power who created the situation in the first place.
So we kind of knew last week, regardless of what that outcome of the vote was going to be, the chances of her actually going and teaching at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill were really pretty slim. But I don't know that this was the outcome we were expecting.
Well, nobody, I don't think anybody saw it coming, but I'm not surprised. And I think, Nicole Hannah-Jones was very eloquent there, and she was also extremely eloquent, and I thought very revealing in a statement that she issued that's on the NAACP's website. They were her lawyers in this case. And, I think this shows us, white people, how much work we really have to do. The fact that we are this far away from Martin Luther King's dream in the 21st century, I certainly sympathize with everything that Nicole Hannah-Jones said, but I think it's incumbent upon those of us who are white and at majority white institutions to step it up and work a little harder.
And that statement, which runs about 8 pages if you read the whole thing. There's a PDF of it that's available on our links blog. I can also tell you that the statement actually aligned very closely with the 9-minute interview, almost 10 minutes, that she did with Gayle King. Almost that if you were to watch them side by, watch it and read it side by side, that you could see how closely they did line up. So you can also watch that full thing on our links blog as well. It is an interesting point that to go to an HBCU really is about being in a place where there actually could be even more good, if you will, done in terms of training journalists for the future and journalists of color.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that you see here is that it's not just Hannah Nicole Jones going to Howard. Ta-Nehisi Coates is also going to Howard, and he was one of the principal architects of getting her in touch with the president at Howard to make all of this happen. Then on top of that, you have the Ford Foundation, which is also giving money, the MacArthur Foundation, which both of them are both MacArthur Genius Scholars. Mm-hmm. So they both brought that money. So it went from a chair that was centered around her at North Carolina to a chair that is now going to be at Howard that includes not only Knight, but MacArthur as well as the Ford Foundation. So you've got a much larger thing to work with. And that in and of itself at a historically black college does really give it more cachet.
And it is going to go even a step beyond that, because while this chair is going to be housed at Howard, the work that they're going to be doing is going to focus on expanding journalism offerings at HBCUs across the country, exactly. Not just at Howard. So right. Programs that tend to be underfunded have fewer resources to really have those resources move in that direction.
Right. And but really what you've seen over the course of, I would say, over the last couple of years has been a much more of a interest in historically black colleges, not just by students of color, but also by benefactors. McKinsey Scott has, in giving away the money that she got during the divorce from Jeff Bezos, has given a lot of money to historically black colleges. So that's increased their profile. And to be honest, I mean, former President Trump and part of some of his initiatives was to also fund historically black colleges. So, I mean, it's, you're starting to see some of that come to fruition, and people are saying, hey, I'm going to go to this space because in this space, I know that I'm wanted and I know that I'm respected, and I'm not going to take my talent somewhere in hopes that I'm going to get that kind of respect and have that kind of influence.
I chuckle, Ernest, as you say that, only because I've been thinking a lot in the last week or so, as we've all been watching this unfold and looking to see what is Nicole Hannah Jones going to do here. And I kept thinking, this reminds me in so many ways of waiting to watch LeBron James say where he was going to take his talents. Yeah, yeah. And how that was kind of one of those stories where we were all as journalists watching Twitter, especially because of her active presence on Twitter, and like, where does she feel she is going to be right. respected and given the room to do the work she can
do? I think one of the things that came out that of her statement that I think is so important to put out there and emphasize, she did not put this story out. She was prepared to swallow her pride and take the 5-year contract and not have tenure. And it was because her right-wing detractors went even further and didn't want her hired at all. That's how the story came out. It was because people were further trying to humiliate her that the story became public. And she has been an absolute class act throughout this whole ordeal. And I just think it's really important to say that. She tried to protect UNC, and other people weren't so careful with its reputation.
And to me, when you start thinking about this, I mean, yes, we've focused a lot on her and what she's now, the decision that she's now made to go to Howard and take her talents there along with further philanthropy coming into Howard University. What about UNC? I mean, now we're talking, now on top of the Silent Sam, on top of the athletic scandal, now you've got this. It is going to be difficult for UNC to get past this and be able to really go out and recruit students, to be able to go out and recruit talent in terms of faculty. They are going to have a very difficult time in the next 4 to 5 years in turning this around. And all of it goes back to exactly what you were talking about, which was you had an agenda that pretty much was saying, either you're going to toe the line the way we want the line to be towed, or you're out.
People did not want to hear. They were willing to take down the reputation of their university because they didn't want to hear a different interpretation of this country's history.
And that's, but that's across the board. I mean, it even goes back to the Silent Sam. I mean, this was not just about their decision to hold up her tenure vote. It's about everything that's happening in that state. If it doesn't meet their strict guidelines in terms of what we think should be taught and how this university should be run, then they're just going to say no.
But this is really a national problem. I mean, it's terrible for UNC, but it's not like anybody is immune from this. I mean, that's what's so painful, I think, about this, that that in this day and age, after all we've been through, we are still in a place where a highly accomplished African-American woman does not feel comfortable, is made to feel uncomfortable in a majority white institution. I mean, it's just hard for me to imagine that this is where we would be at this stage in my life.
So let's go back up north a little bit to Howard, because you could say yesterday's announcement helped deflect some of the negative attention thrown Howard's way after the university's newish dean of the College of Fine Arts tweeted her support for Bill Cosby upon his release from prison last Wednesday. In it, Felicia Rashad, his Cosby Show wife, said, "Finally, a terrible wrong is being righted, a miscarriage of justice corrected." But the backlash was strong from people who wanted to know how she could, apparently, choose not to believe Cosby's accusers. Here's one of them, Victoria Valentino, talking to CNN.
One thing after another, the domino effect of women finding their voices and feeling empowered to speak out against their perpetrators. You know, I think for many years, everybody thought that women who were raped or sexually assaulted or incest victims were in the minority. But no, that's not true, Allison. It was because we didn't have a voice and people were afraid to speak out.
So, Kathy, you sent a bunch of different links to me about reactions people were having about this. A lot of these are very strong, which in some ways kind of made me wonder about Felicia Rashad, made me think too about some of the deans who I know. In fact, one of the people sitting next to me has a title of dean. Her going forward and saying that, yes, she has this personal experience with Bill Cosby, but it seemed like a very tone-deaf action to take in that moment.
Well, I think it's understandable that somebody, your immediate reaction when somebody you know well and care about is under attack, it's understandable that you would want to defend that person. But I think what made the reaction so strong against Dean Rashad was that this wasn't in the heat of the moment. I mean, Bill Cosby has admitted that he drugged women so that he could sexually assault them. And it's interesting, I sent you a link yesterday, yeah. Dean Rashad's ex-husband, Ahmad Rashad, who was also a good friend of Bill Cosby. In fact, Bill Cosby and O.J. Simpson were at the wedding of those two, the Rashads. And he said a couple of years ago when he was asked about it, he talked about how it's such a gut punch when something like this happens to people you know and you respect, but he made it very clear that he believed the accusers. And I think at this stage of the game, when we've seen the depositions and we've seen what Cosby admitted to, it's hard to argue that this was a miscarriage of justice.
Yeah, I would definitely disagree with her statement mm-hmm. in terms of miscarriage of justice. I think you're right. I mean, I think it was a reaction to what was happening. But she didn't stop to think about how your words, how your tweets are going to have an impact not only on you as an individual, but also the institution that you represent. And so now she finds herself in this sort of space where you're having to pull everything back, which she tried to do.
She did try to do, yeah. In a letter of apology to students and parents. But she does kind of have this foot in two different worlds. And yeah, she's the grandma on This Is Us, but she's also the dean at a prominent university where she is in some ways responsible for students and making sure that they are in a safe environment to be able to learn.
Right, and the thing about it, they brought her in to mm-hmm. be that sort of model for these students, and one of the first acts as dean is to put out a statement like this. I mean, you know, granted, Bill Cosby was released on a technicality. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone who's read it and understands it
and,
knows
and
that.
And his own legal team will
yeah. So
talk to that.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So to
like
say
everybody
that,
knows that.
Right. So to say that, you know, it was a miscarriage, it's like, well, wait a minute. You know, he, as you said, he actually admitted it. And the only reason it was overturned was because it was a deal that was in place at before the trial even happened. So, I mean, she just didn't think before she did.
Yeah, one of the things we tell students is stop before you move those thumbs on your phone, just especially if you're in a state of high emotion, think before you hit that tweet, right. The send button. this is a classic case.
So some other legal issues to talk about. One of the things that former President Donald Trump said he wanted to accomplish as president was to substantially change the libel laws in this country. Well, this week, Supreme Court Justices Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch said that they think it's time to revisit its standards on libel to counteract misinformation in the digital age. That the way it is now, a journalist with actual malice has to knowingly and intentionally publish something that they know is false. Their argument is that now anybody has the ability to publish with their mobile device in an instant, and that perhaps revisiting New York Times versus Sullivan is the opportunity to fight some of the misinformation and disinformation that's out there on social media.
Yeah, well, this is the legacy media, the traditional media, which has always abided by, in large part, responsible standards, getting tarred by social media. This is one of the problems, and you would think Supreme Court justices would be a little more sophisticated and realize that, your crazy Cousin Vinny's post on Facebook is not the same as the New York Times. There is a cure for this. I understand the justice's concerns, but there is a cure for this, and it's not reversing New York Times v. Sullivan. And I'm going to get in some trouble with some of my First Amendment friends about this. But the cure is repealing Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which essentially gives online internet platforms a pass from the libel laws. The same thing that would get the Columbia, Missourian sued, or the New York Times sued, on Facebook, on Twitter, on any social media platform, doesn't get a lawsuit. That's the problem. The problem is not our current libel laws. The problem is the exemption from those libel laws for internet platforms.
I'm right there with you, and it's probably going to get me in trouble too, but I agree with you. Because of that particular part of the act, these entities are able to put out this misinformation and to go after
with impunity,
absolutely.
Right.
And I think if there's ever a case that comes up that deals specifically with that, I would not be surprised if the Chief Justice didn't put that on the docket and say, okay, we do need to look at this
because
there
we're on
is
the same
issue.
Side as Donald Trump and Josh Hawley on this one.
Yeah,
I'm just
kind of sitting here wide-eyed at the moment.
There is an interesting bipartisan consensus developing on this. And, you know, I will say that, no diss to the people who wrote Section 230, but this was back in 1996. And the idea was to protect this fledgling means of communication.
What they didn't know was that it was going to spin out of control.
It ain't a garage band anymore.
Right.
You know, so I think Google and Facebook and all of the rest of them have enough money to hire some editors, which is what it would take. But that's the resistance. They don't want to hire human beings to edit because human beings are so inconvenient, they require health insurance.
And they don't want this to change because, I mean, here's the thing. They already have a army of lawyers that are trying to protect them over in Europe and mm-hmm. in other places because they don't have this act. They don't have that protection. Now, therefore, if this changes, then they'll have to hire an even larger army to deal with it here in the United States, and they definitely do not want that to happen. And that's one of their concerns, along with having to hire editors and that sort of thing.
Right. They could hire an army of editors and solve their problem, and we have some of them right in the next room they could hire.
That's true.
They're very well trained.
So another aspect of this that could also help is that we, as a civilized population, could also be a little bit more media literate. And I was talking to a student yesterday about a series of readings I added to teach that course to our non-journalism majors about how journalists are not the enemy. And along with the links to the articles I show, because this is an online course, so there's photos involved and stuff too. So I show this Reuters photo of a group of people wearing gas masks in the press gallery at the House of Representatives with one of my former students. That's Jill Ornitz. It's in the foreground wearing the black top and the vest. Well, 6 months later, here we are 6 months from the riot at the Capitol, and there are still so many journalists who have been traumatized to the point they still aren't able to return to Capitol Hill. Vice has done a really good piece on this that you can read on our links blog. Meanwhile, the Justice Department has moved into a new phase, if you will, of arrests and prosecutions, going after those who assaulted journalists on that day. And this is a bit of an about face from the conversations we've been having about the Department of Justice in the past month or month and a half, where they had been seizing phone records and stuff, now coming to the defense of journalists.
No, I was going to say, you know, this to me, this isn't surprising. I mean, you have a new attorney general and Merrick Garland, who has said that, you know, we're going to take a different stand than what was the way the Justice Department was run during the Trump administration. And you clearly were able to see how journalists were attacked during the insurrection. And for the Justice Department not to have done what they did this week, that would have been a travesty in and of itself, because, I mean, there were hundreds of thousands of dollars of equipment that was that was destroyed. You had journalists who were physically assaulted, and the people who were doing the assaults
recorded themselves doing it.
They sent texts out to friends saying that they were doing it. They were doing, you know, Instagram Live. I mean, Facebook Live with the whole thing. I mean, these are easy cases to win. I mean, I suspect that many of them will be pled out, but you know, this was an easy one for the Justice Department to do.
Pleading out is still a win. You were going to say something.
Yeah, well, I think it's good that they're doing this, but it's really less about journalists than it is about law and order. These are assaults.
Yeah. It's an assault.
They were assaults. It doesn't matter that the people were journalists. There might be an extra charge if you assaulted a cop, but here it's a matter of people were assaulted. Now, the reason those journalists were targeted was because of their press credentials.
And the cameras they were carrying.
But so that made them targets.
Right.
But the charge here is going to be assault, I'm sure. And an assault on any individual ought to be
assault,
prosecuted.
You got destruction of property. And some of these same people also assaulted police officers, which you talked to, you just mentioned. So they've got that charge on top of the other charges. So yeah, this was an easy one.
Yeah, and they're providing their own evidence.
That's right.
Thank you very much.
So before we go, celebrating the golden anniversary of the film that made us each want to unwrap a candy bar and find the golden ticket, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Here's the actor, now grown up, who played Charlie, talking about the first time he walked into Willy Wonka's Wonderland.
Yeah, when that door opened, we had not seen the Great Chocolate Room, and It was really neat. It was magical and big. That's what I remember. And, you know, just lots of color and you know, working with Gene, you know, during his song and everything, and the whole, you know, entrance down the staircase and pulling Paris's hair, one of my favorite scenes.
So this film, I will admit, it's one of my favorites. Although I do still get a little bit sick to my stomach when they get to the end of that scene, when they're in the boat and they've got kind of the psychedelic, they're going really fast. And I used to describe being on Lower Wacker Drive in a CTA bus when some of the drivers would get out of control is kind of being like that scene from Willy Wonka. There's something about this film, though, that after 50 years, it really does still transcend generations.
Yeah, well, I'm so old, I read the book first.
Okay.
but yeah, it's a magical story. And I think this is one of those wonderful books that, and it came out just as well, if not better, in the movie, because it's great to see how the wonderful writing of Roald Dahl actually inspired these amazing sets. And of course, great acting, just
yep. The great acting, the songs that people remember. Mm-hmm. That to me,
I want the world. Yeah, I want the whole world. Yeah. Yep.
I mean, you don't even have to hear the words. I mean, you just hear the music. Once the music starts, you know exactly what it is and what's about to come and what does it look like. I mean, so to me, this is one of those as you said, it's one of those movies that transcends, but it's also one of those movies that can connect to various age groups. So
I think that's right. It transcends generations.
Yeah, yes.
And I think really great children's literature also speaks to adults. It's really almost an allegory.
Yeah. And I think it's something that, I mean, I'm just thinking about, I knew we were going to talk about this. I was thinking about my grandson and the fact that I feel like this is a movie that I could sit down and watch with him when he gets a little older, and he will be able to understand it and connect with it, because who doesn't like candy? You know, and they have all sorts of candy there. I mean, you don't necessarily have to be a chocolate lover. There was other types of candy in that movie as well.
And when you also look at kind of the lasting effect of that candy, you could then take your grandson to Hy-Vee and go get a theater box of Gobstoppers,
right?
And you can connect it there too. Interestingly enough, Roald Dahl never liked this film. Always thought that it was a little too much, a little over the top, and that perhaps the remake that was done with Johnny Depp, I don't know if you've seen that one.
I've seen that one, yeah.
So thoughts on that one? Because he always thought that one was a little bit more in line with his vision.
Yeah, but it doesn't. That movie did not connect with me the way the other one did.
It's dark
know if it was,
and it's creepy.
Yeah, thank you. It was dark. Yeah. And there was a little bit of that in Gene Wilder's film, but in the Johnny Depp one, they just took it to another degree, and I was like, "That doesn't connect with me." And maybe it had something to do with the fact that I really connected with the other one because I saw it when I was much younger.
Yeah, I think it's a different medium, and I think writers have a different view of you know what their words mean, and you're almost inevitably going to have a writer not because words give room to imagination, and so somebody might imagine Willy Wonka looking one way, but the movie takes that away from you. But the movie does other things that you can't do in words, and that's certainly one of the things that we talk about in our multimedia classes. Is each medium serves a different gateway for different readers, and so or different audiences, and I think it's the same in literature.
Okay, well, that music means we are out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about on our links blog. That's under both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads. That includes iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is at Views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to the program again, leave comments, questions, see what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our theme music. I'm Amy Simons. We'll see you next week.